Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Bodleian Library. My name is Samuel Fanous. I'm the publisher at the library, and I have the privilege of introducing our speakers this afternoon. But before I do, could I ask you please just to take a moment and make sure your phones are switched off, and in case there is in the unlikely event that the fire alarm goes, I'm told to say that the exit is through the back door, the way you came in. Brian Sewell is one of Britain's most influential art critics.
That's not true.
It is.
I have no influence at all.
Since 1984, he's worked as the art critic for the Evening Standard, where he's won numerous awards for his articles and essays. From this vantage point, he has pronounced with unflinching directness on a wide variety of subjects, including, of course, modern art and artists. He likes to provoke, but he also likes, and perhaps this is much less acknowledged, to make people smile and laugh. He likes, he says, to instruct, ever hopeful that artists might yet be inspired to produce great works of art as they have in previous ages. His two volumes of memoirs, released in 2011 and 12, have been described by reviewers as among the most elegantly written, brutally frank, and gripping memoirs in recent times, with revelations about a huge range of subjects, chiefly the author himself. He decided to publish his memoirs, he says, in the hope that others who find themselves suffering as he once did could gain courage from the fact that they're not alone. In that regard, he's a bit like our second speaker, Roy Strong. Sir Roy holds the unique distinction of being not only the youngest ever director of the National Portrait Gallery, but also of the V&A. He's credited with transforming both from much-loved but perhaps somewhat stuffy institutions into places teeming with a sense of flair and colour and pageantry. His exhibitions at both the NPG and the V&A are still referenced to this day as landmarks in the history of museum and gallery exhibition. His display of Cecil Beaton photographs at the NPG was so successful that the queues became a news item. Suddenly, the gallery had arrived into the swinging 60s. Remarkable when you think that just a few years earlier, the secretaries at the NPG were forced to drink a glass of warm milk every morning at 11 o'clock because the director thought they looked peaky. Since leaving the V&A, Sir Roy has worked as a writer, a broadcaster, and a gardener. He's written over 25 books on topics as diverse as the coronation and small gardens. The publication of his diaries in 1997 caused something of a sensation, with revelations about members of the royal family and other prominent individuals. In his latest book, Self-Portrait as a Young Man, he turns the lens on himself, examining his life before he became well known. Here, he tells us about his parents, his childhood home, his siblings, his grammar school education, the debt he owes to his teachers, and his break from all this into his new life in the center of London. It is, as he pithily says, the story of a young man who came from nowhere and who went somewhere. Will you please welcome our speakers?
I hope you're not expecting a Jonathan Ross and Russell Brand show. This is really Roy's afternoon, not mine. So I would like to ask you I would like to provoke you into telling us more, particularly about your childhood. There's a very sad little passage at the beginning of the book which says that you spent so much of your life trying to escape. That at the time you were trying to escape, and you've tried to escape ever since, and eventually become what you have become. And even so, it still haunts, I feel. So can you tell us more about it?
About escaping?
No, about... you're a little younger than me.
Not much.
Not much, no.
Some of us have worn better than others.
I don't think we should go into that.
Oh, I do.
It is turning into the Jonathan Ross series. No. You painted a very clear picture of life as we got out of the war. And there is something about during the war. But then it moves into that very austere period afterwards, in which I think conditions were really rather worse than they had been during the war itself. And it's an area that I think I left out of mine. So you tell us more.
Well, I think that would divide us. And there's not many years that divide us, actually, because we're almost of an age. But I think the great divide is 1939 and the outbreak of war. My eldest brother remembered before 1939. My parents were actually happy when there was a degree of money around. I, of course, didn't remember before the war, and therefore my main memory was of being brought up in a house where the marriage was a complete disaster, and which centered on the principle, whatever you do, don't tell your father, where my father was left with £5 a week to bring up a family of five, which was not funny. On the other hand, it created this era of deprivation and frustration. And I think it's summed up in one anecdote I put in the book. I remember years later, I was asked by the University of Birmingham, they had a lecture which endowed by some good citizen who went to the United States and made a whole lot of money, which he left, part of which he left to the University of Birmingham for an annual lecture on the theme of happiness. And I glibly said, oh yes, I'll do that. And that is not an easy lecture to give. I looked at some of the people who gave it, and some sidestepped what that was really about. And then there was one person who rang up the week before and said they couldn't go through with it. And I thought, well, you're either absolutely honest. And I remember standing and staring at that audience. When you're a child, you're born into a circumstance. You don't realize until later in life, when I hope each of us has experienced great happiness, which I did, in my marriage and in the creation of the garden, you suddenly realize that you had a very unhappy childhood. And certainly in my case, I stared at that audience, I said, can I now give thanks for unhappiness? Because it gave me, in a sense, my life's work. In a way, it was dangerous. It made me turn away to imaginary worlds. So I played with Pollock's toy theaters, or I sat and quietly in a corner, painted pictures. I explored the past and history and art under the encouragement of some incredible school teachers. So in fact, it already, this is one of the things I have against contemporary education, where nobody is made to fail. And I think it's terribly important that you come up against things early in life, something really awful, because it actually conditions how you look at things and what you treasure and the direction your mind and imagination takes. So in fact, if I'd have had a happier childhood, I might never have ended up director of the V&A, and maybe that was a good thing that I didn't.
No, oh, no, come on. You were, I think, the most exciting and inspiring director of the V&A, far more than your predecessor, Pope Hennessy, of whom I remember almost nothing except for the Bronzes exhibition, which was a great...
Well, then he had a 19th century door knocker in it, didn't he?
Well, all his attributions were wrong, pretty well. Oh.
That's the world of art history, which is one of the reasons I'm glad I got out of it.
There's some really one nasty little bit in your book, which is, I think it says, there was nothing I wanted more than to go to the Courtauld Institute and study the history of art. But someone told me that everybody had to be in Debrett in order to get into the Institute, which is simply not true. There was a myth about the Courtauld Institute that before the war, that is from 1932 to 39, it did close down in Ascot Week and girls were presented and so on. But that was a world away from what it was in my day, which is 1954 onwards.
Well, I only get that impression, my impression of the quarter, which I wanted to go to, and I couldn't remember the name of the registrar, I think it was Charles Clare. Well, he was incredibly upset that there was no facility to allow somebody It was a system of applying, and I would have had to wait a year. There was no year way I could wait a year. There was not a penny to live on. And that's why I ended up reading history in Queen Mary College in the Mile End Road. But to go back to the courtauld, when I was an undergraduate, there was a great friend. He died very young. He went blind. Called Cedric Holland, and he'd been at the courtauld, and he simply couldn't stand it because it was so insufferably upper class that he felt excluded at every juncture. Then, of course, I had, when I sort of went on about the courtauld to the various history people, they always said, oh, you don't want to go. No, 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 the courtauld's no good. You must go to the Warburg Institute, and to the Warburg Institute I went.
Eventually.
Eventually.
Yes. Actually, Cedric Holland, your close friend, was, I cannot imagine what got into him, because Cedric turned up at Haberdashers, which was the school at which I was, which was supposed to be a public school, but it was in fact no better than an ordinary grammar school. And
was rather dismissive. Go on.
Well, it certainly wasn't Eton. I think I said in my book that most of the boys there were the sons of shopkeepers, which is true. I mean, it's simply true. It is not a thing about being snobbish. And in any case, it was the only school I could get into. So I have some reason to be grateful to it. But Cedric turned up at school for my last 2 years there. He came straight, I think, into the sixth form, the lower sixth and then the upper sixth. And he was the most frightful snob. And I was once taken home to have tea with his mother, who was at pains to tell me that she was one of the hotels of Leicester. Did he never tell?
No, I never had any of that. Yeah.
And then when Cedric had his reciprocal tea with me, we had the first Camembert cheese that had been seen since 1939. And he peeled it.
Oh.
So,
touche.
There.
Now, what else do you want to know?
I want to know about Walsingham, because I was brought up as a Roman Catholic, and my mother married a rather ordinary middle-level Anglican who was rather keen on church music, but not keen on thurible and stuff, and so I was actually confirmed into the Church of England, much to my regret, and then had to be, as it were, deconfirmed and reconfirmed, and it all got rather complicated. And then, of course, I fell out of love with the religion when I was about 28. You, slightly older than that, fell in love with it at Walsingham, of all places.
No, younger than that.
Well, not much.
No, yeah, about sort of 8 years younger.
Oh, I didn't read your book very carefully. It's not.
Well, that's your problem.
It's not. No, what everybody's problem is going to be is it's not very good on dates. You say on July the 25th, but you don't say in which year.
Well, each chapter is very tightly within a 3-year boundary.
Yes, but there's a lot of difference between July the 25th in 1953 and 1956.
Now you're upbraiding my editor.
Yeah. Oh, well, don't talk to me about editors.
Oh, I love my editor.
editors don't read for sense. They don't read for grammar.
You've
they
been
don't
very
read
unlucky.
For publication, about punctuation.
So
they don't know about semicolons. Nor do you, for that matter.
Yes.
No, but tell us, I'm interested to know why you, at an age when I was drifting away from belief, suddenly had a revelation. What happened at Walsingham?
Well, I don't think anybody can explain a feeling of revelation or, I suppose, a conversion experience. I don't think you can ever explain it in a rational way. I've written absolutely honestly about it, and I literally went there by accident. It was There happened to be an extra car, extra seat in the car, and they were all going up to Walsingham, which I didn't know what it was. Mad, and I thought, oh, lovely trip to Norfolk, all those old churches. And suddenly, for the first time, I came up against, not against, but suddenly amazed by people who had such a deep sense of piety and commitment and prayerfulness. And I was suddenly aware that there was something missing in my life, and maybe that's how life may have worked out for you, but it didn't for me, and I've been incredibly grateful to that. I've always remained a loyal Anglican, because I love Anglicanism. It's always in a mess. That's what I love about the Anglican Church. It keeps every window open, and it sort of says, well, you know, we don't know this, but then perhaps God doesn't mean us to know this particular thing. So it's a very sort of flexible creed. And certainly it's seen me through a lot, a very great deal, with some very fine priests who have been close to me. And I certainly think that things that I've had to cope with, I would not have had to cope with as well as I have. And I certainly think the process of bereavement, certainly when my wife died, was hugely helped by the structure that faith gives, of thankfulness, of recall, and of closure, of all those different acts of remembrance. And I'm not in the least apologetic for that. And I, every October the 10th, I will go to the cathedral at Hereford, and my wife is remembered at the altar. And that to me is terribly important, and there are certain other days. And I would never challenge anybody who hadn't got it, but certainly it has been something central in my life. And Dame Frances Yates, who taught me an awful lot and really mucked me up in one way, she always sort of envisaged me as a canon in an old cathedral close, sort of sitting around, and maybe she was right in a way. And I find this phase of life, I should be 78 in August, immensely tranquil. I'm doing something which would horrify Brian. I'm an altar server in Hereford Cathedral and help them in any way I can. And I have an honorary role at Westminster Abbey. It's like being a spear carrier in a Shakespeare play. Well, I get the most marvelous robe. It is blue velvet trimmed with gold with a Tudor ruffian. And I look simply wonderful in it.
I was wondering what you'd wear today.
Well, it's just a bit of shabby old blue
should
velvet.
I
haven't got a plunging neckline like you.
It's only because the button has fallen off. No, I don't know why you think I might be shocked or horrified by what you just said, because
I'm not... lost your faith. I gained it. One of the things you don't explain in your book is suddenly on page about 50 or something, you say, well, I abandoned my desire to be a Roman Catholic priest. It was the first time we'd ever heard about it. But we're not doing your book, you're doing it tomorrow.
No, we're doing it. Exactly. No, that's the whole point. For me, I'm left with a residual sort of respect, which is profound for people who have a real belief.
Don't worry, I'll light a candle for you tomorrow.
No, don't. Light it for somebody else. I went to Lourdes once and was very disturbed by what I found there, but very impressed by the beliefs of other people. My skepticism was really under attack there. But, there it is. Did you meet Frieda Brackley when you were in Walsingham?
Yeah.
Oh. She was...
What was she?
Oh, she'd been in at the beginning of Walsingham as a sort of...
I was just a lowly hanger-on.
I thought she was Ludwig Mond's daughter. And
oh, well, that gets back into your world.
A convert.
Yeah. Okay.
And as is so often the case with converts, doubly passionate about it all. Yeah, well, never mind. What do you think about women priests?
That doesn't worry me. No, that doesn't worry me at all.
Oh.
Why should it? No, that doesn't worry me. I also have this kind of belief when I think each century in progressive revelation, and I think it was a revelation reserved for the 20th century, and I give great gratitude for it. I mean, okay, I could do without women priests who are over 60 with curled grey hair and dangling earrings, but that's a dreadful sort of fascist remark to make, and I'm ashamed that I've said it. but you know what I mean. And no, I'm for all that.
Women bishops?
Yes, that's fine.
Gay marriage?
Yes.
I'm surprised.
Well, you must have led a very sheltered life.
I think it's a good deal less sheltered than yours.
Well, yes.
One way.
Well, depends what you're sheltering from.
Yes. Yeah, I am surprised the number of highly intelligent people who are in favour of gay marriage. It just seems to be such a nonsense, a contradiction in terms. Right. However.
Well, no, I would prefer if everything was left at the moment whereby there's a civil marriage blessed by a priest. But I mean, 10 days ago in Hereford, which is pretty remote, there were 250 people turned up in the cathedral to hear Geoffrey John, who is the Dean of St. Albans, theologian, deeply, deeply Christian man who has a civil partnership with Father Grant, give with scriptural basis utter clarity. It's a brilliant mind, but with that simplicity which everyone could understand. And then there was a moment when they suddenly said, everyone who is against same-sex unions put their hands up. Not one hand went up in that entire gathering of people. And Hereford's quite an old-fashioned rural county, so it's really where the people in the pews are ahead of the people, up above. And it was a very extraordinary occasion. I was incredibly surprised and very touched by it. Anyway, that's sort of off the topic of my wonderful life.
Yes, yes. You write of Francis Yates with considerable passion. Francis Yates was, one of the great monuments of the Warburg Institute. And for those of you who don't know what the Warburg is, it was an institution unknown in English academe, and it arrived with a thump in 1934 in the Commonwealth Institute in London, as it then was. And suddenly it opened everybody's eyes to the idea that there was more to scholarship than any of us had ever thought, that scholarship was one of those things that has very curious ties across disciplines, and that it's often the idea that is more important, or the series of ideas that are developed, than the works of art that the courtyard would study. So if you were a courtyard student, you were very much aware of the Warburg, because it lent such extraordinary depth to the history of art, which is not a shallow subject in itself. And Roy is one of those people who, having taken a degree at Queen Mary College, was then well qualified to go into the history of the cultural background of the period in which he was interested and dig deeply. Francis Yates was his supervisor. And Francis, I knew only from her occasional lectures at the Courtyard Institute, which were delivered with considerable aplomb and absolute unquestioning certainty. I should have said unquestionable. And I think that's what you encountered, somebody who wanted to do your research for you, control it.
Well, no, it was quite a complicated relationship with her. I mean, the way she released my mind, because when you, most undergraduate subjects at that period, at any rate, were along a one track, and also anything to do with the history of culture or biography or anything like that, or art was kind of some bit of flummery on top of the cake. and then suddenly to go to a place which knew no boundaries between the disciplines, and you were, and I would say, I can't do that, it's theology, or it's music, or it's something or other. You have a trained mind. You take the book from the shelf and you read it. Jump in, splash around a bit. You'll make a few mistakes. Well, it was simply, I mean, she was a cross between Margaret Rutherford and Passport to Pimlico and Madame Arcati. But it was releasing, and she'd say, well, how do we know Philip Sidney didn't know Shakespeare? Well, let's just imagine they met, they're walking along the Strand. Where does this lead us? And it was that total release from undergraduate history, which was all constitutional and economic, and it was all about the peasants, and I'm not interested in the peasants. They're awfully boring people. I love the aristocracy. It's a very unfashionable view, because Marxist history was all over the place. But, I mean, Warburg was immensely liberating on the mind, but on the other hand, what it did, which I explain, which was what happened in the post-war period. I mean, the whole expansion of the universities was based on the notion it would help the economy of the country. How me doing spending, in the end, 6 years on Elizabethan court pageantry as propaganda was going to solve the economic dilemmas of Britain, I still can't fathom out. But that's how it was. But I'm profoundly grateful to that institution, which made me unflinching in being able to say, well, plunge in and have a look. And in the 80s, when I felt I've got to take another direction, I really must get out of the V&A, I've said everything that I can say about this place. I've got tenure till 65, but it will mentally atrophy me, and also it won't be any good for the place. And that was then I began writing books on garden design, because I thought, well, I've got a trained mind. I can write about garden design. You've just got to start looking and reading and writing. Very successful it was too. But that's how things were. And also I came a bit, I have a profound respect for the world of academe, but then there's a bit of me which it exalts itself in a way and made you feel that every other form of existence was a lower form of life. And the people in the Warburg were just not in the land of the living. And when I found myself in the portrait gallery, you know, I was dealing with
rudimentary. That was the land of the dead.
Well, it was the land of the dead, but I mean, I was putting photographs in boxes or writing some boring thing about a, you know, portrait drawing done in the 1920s, and it was all just day-to-day humdrum existence. And the world of academe, and it was, in the end, it was about, you know, how you do exhibitions, the practicalities, dealing with the Ministry of Works, dealing with all those complicated things, which are the practicalities that make things happen for the wide public. And how do you harness those, and how do you turn them to taking something over to the public? And all that is very different from sitting with a book in a library and writing yet another learned article that you and five other people will foam at the mouth with excitement about and the rest of the world won't care. You still there?
I'm still going, yes. I made a note. You said after 10 years with Francis Yates, who wrote your friend Jan van Dorsten, I saw Yates last Monday. It was an annihilating experience. After 2 hours, I left wanting to put my head in the gas oven and felt mentally depressed ever since. Her main theme seems to be that nothing I had produced was any good, really useless, and that I am a glossy, successful young man who has sold himself to a life of glamour and ostentation. Was any of that true?
Well, there's a bit of it true. I think the thing is that also you belong to the age of the academic power mongers. I don't know whether it still goes on in this university or elsewhere, but certainly the 50s and 60s, you saw the decline in the 20th century of the power of the aristocracy after the Parliament Act of 1911, but they perpetuated their power by being on boards of museums and galleries, for instance. And then came the expansion of the universities, so there came up people like Lord Annan and all those people who were life peers, who were academics. And so you got a kind of shift in power. And I cite, and I remember when that happened at the National Portrait Gallery, J.H. Plum, Jack Plum came on, eventually Sir Jack Plum. And it's summed up by a remark, which I always remember, it was Lord Kenyon, who was again the old aristocrat, saying, I fulfill my aristocratic duty, I sit on all these boards. And then he said about Plum, he's the sort of man that buys other people's silver. Well, that sums that, and that, no, that actually sums up all the class attitudes, which was still there all through the 50s and into the early 60s, and were just beginning to break down. And I'm not being funny about that at all. And so Yeats and, to some extent, those academic people, you were kind of another diamond in their kind of crown. I mean, Neil, Sir John Neil was another one. There's a whole list of those people. And I swore I'd never be one of those people. They wanted to dominate in that kind of way. And Yeats was a bit like that. And I was here, it was interesting, I was hearing, because I was talking about this to somebody, and they said how David Starkey, who kind of drives me mad, but at the same time I have a respect for him, he in the end, it was G.R. Elton who taught him, and in the end he had to break, he had to have a kind of flaming row and go off and do his own thing. And I think it was the same thing that with Francis Yates, as long as you were a satellite, it was all right. But as long as you became, but then you can be somebody in your own right and take your own path. That wasn't light. You were all right as long as you were another diamond in the star. But I always respected her. The only time I was taken out for lunch by the honours man, I put her name forward, and she began to get those honours, which she so richly deserved. She was a great historian, great, a very, very remarkable woman. She went sort of a bit bonkers at the end, but then perhaps we all do, that's all right. So that was a tortured relationship. But I think many people who are students know what it is, that extraordinary dialogue with the older and, as it were, the more mature intellect, with the one that is still in formation. And then eventually there comes a moment when it doesn't always, but often it in the end just snaps. And I'm glad it snapped, because it enabled me to think about the public and the people who came to the museum and what they were going to enjoy and how we could take all this out. I mean, an early book I wrote, it was called Splendor at Court, which synthesized everything about the new subject of court festivals, pageants, triumphal arches, all that sort of stuff. And she apparently wrote in her diary, this book is entirely derivative. Well, of course it was, but it was written in order to take that thrilling subject out to a much wider audience. But that would not have been liked at all. It was regarded as a betrayal. You're good at doing all that. Look at the Evening Standard. You take things out to the public in a fantastic way.
Oh, how kind. I'm not sure that it has any effect. But anyway, we're talking about you. I have always felt that you and I were, in a sense, lucky by being born when we were, more or less, in that we benefited from being around in the 1960s. It seems to me an awful lot of nonsense is now talked about the 60s. It's become romanticized and, in a sense, abused by people who are far too young to have been there or experienced the strange phenomenon that the 60s were. One aspect of the 60s was the way in which the aristocracy, for want of a better word, took up promising young men. They took up, for example, David Hockney. David Hockney was born at precisely the right moment and emerged from the Royal College at precisely the right moment for people to get excited about the supposedly extraordinary promise. And I think Roy was another sort of candidate for their patronage. Dinner parties and things like that. I know that I got asked to dinner parties and weekends in country houses for no better reason than that I was a sort of bright young thing.
Nothing wrong with that.
Rather nice. No, but it is. It is patronizing and curiously uncomfortable.
I think the people that opened up in the 60s to the generation like myself and Hockney and the rest of it, and the kind of group, really, and don't forget, it was a very narrow swathe of people, the 60s. But the people who took me up were the people who in the 30s, 20s and 30s, have been part of the rather what I call high bohemia beau monde. Who were always, they loved people like Rex Whistler, didn't they, and all that coterie of artists. So you found, after the war, they found, I mean, sort of, you know.
I don't think we were nearly as interesting.
Not picked up, but it's an awful expression. I mean, I got on like a house on fire with the Queen Mother, Lady Diana Cooper, Lady Pamela Berry. I mean, the list goes on. And I can always remember when I arrived, it was Nigel Lawson, who then looked like the young George IV. He's changed a bit since. And gave a very grand dinner because it was a period of great entertaining. And I was placed between Diana Cooper and Lady Antonia Fraser. And I saw the frisson around the table because I'd never been seen before. Who was this young man suddenly placed between the two great beauties of two eras? Mm. And I thought, well, this is interesting. But I did take it all in. But I wasn't seduced by it in the end.
I was always desperately uncomfortable with it.
No idea, what am I doing here? Yeah. Well, I was enjoying myself.
Oh, I think that's part of my...
And I've always, I'm unashamed in loving style and glamour. Hello, yes?
No, I'm ruminating on style and glamour. I've never had either, so...
Well, it's a rather bad aspect of me, really.
You were rather fond of clothes, weren't you?
I love clothes.
At a time when clothes were becoming...
No, I always go for a good look for a senior citizen.
Oh, that is not...
I've always had
clothes. You were a bit of a macaroni in your
youth. Oh, yes, in my youth, yes, I had... Yes. It's mostly in the V&A, but the Fashion Museum in Bath has got everything I've worn from 1965 to 2005. And I went after my wife died, we cleared everything up, and I had packaged things and labelled and dated them and put them all out. And they came down, and I said, look, just take the lot. Just give it to Oxfam if there's anything there. And then last year I went down to the Costume Museum in Bath and there were all these things sitting on racks. I said, but you've hung on to them. And I began to look at them and I thought, curiously enough, they're quite interesting. And I said, does anybody look at these things? Oh, yes. And it might be quite interesting to have one person who's been interested in fashion, one man's clothes running the whole way through. May not be interesting to you, but I've always been interested and fascinated by the history of dress and I could have written a lot on it. And I still keep connections in that direction. There's a marvelous woman who's just starting a school of historical dress. I mean, really serious. And again, to see the new breakthroughs. They're now, for instance, she's done a wonderful thing in the V&A. She's not a member of the V&A staff. X-raying, we ever thought of X-raying dress? I mean, to see an X-ray of a 17th century woman's bodice, you can see the stitches were used, where the tailor, how it was cut, where the embroiderer came in, where the buttons came from. Was it altered because she got fatter or thinner? And again, seeing these advances in a subject which, when I came up, was just regarded as, you know, something to be laughed at. And to see the history of dress advance from being something which was regarded as, you know, rather sort of risible, really, to being regarded as a serious academic discipline, I think it's something which is marvellous.
I think you have the Courtauld Institute, some...
They sat aloof.
No.
She was rather wonderful, that woman. What was she called?
Stella Newton.
Stella Mary Newton, yes. Yes, she was rather splendid.
She was teaching me the history of costume.
I mean, the most difficult thing when starting the history of costume was that all the women involved in it hated each other.
Isn't that true of all women involved in anything?
I do not have such a prejudiced view. I've known some male feuds on a monumental scale.
I have a vague memory, and you must put me out of my misery because I really cannot sort of put the date to it, and it may not have happened at all, in which case it's a figment of my fevered imagination, that you put on an exhibition at the National Portrait Gallery, which involved having sort of sandy shingle paths through the various rooms.
Oh, why do you think of the Mask of Beauty?
Well, I don't know.
It was the one that was denounced by the Burlington magazine. If that's the way the portrait gallery was going under Roy Strong, it was a national disgrace.
With real trees growing.
Well, I can tell you why that show happened. It was because I was trying to negotiate a Graham Sutherland exhibition. It would have been the first modern portrait exhibition in the portrait gallery. And I wanted it. It eventually happened under my successor. And why it founded was because of the tax rules and because Graham was in the south of France. It all founded around the Inland Revenue. And I had to run a show in fast. So I thought, okay, well, let's do all the most beautiful women through the ages. Well, I'm afraid Diana Dawes got in. That was a terrible mistake. and then too many aristocratic ladies got in. So again...
What is beauty?
Yes, well, what is beauty? But no, but there were certain people that were regarded as great beauties in their time. And the whole show, I got Ken Turner, who was then, he may still be going strong, the greatest flower arranger in London. So the whole thing was full of kind of beech leaves and great branches. And it was frightfully camp, but wildly successful.
Was that the same exhibition in which everybody was given a large paper bag and told to tie two eye holes in it and put it over their heads?
No, I think that was either elsewhere or under an imaginative successor. Was it Instant Image 1970?
It was definitely...
Instant Image 1970, I'm proud of. When I wrote that, published my diaries, I didn't realize how important that was and became an icon. This is beyond the period of the book I write, became an icon to the younger generation. I got David Hockney, Gerald Scarfe, and David Bailey, each to do portraits, you know, the whole portrait exhibition around there. And it caused a sensation. There's a whole series of photographs of Helmut Berger, Marissa Berenson running along stark naked, and I had to kind of shuffle the royal personage who opened it past all of this. It was terribly funny. But anyway, it caused a great scandal because Harold Wilson was depicted in bed with the gnomes of Zurich in a rather explicit way. And we did this jointly with the Welsh Arts Council. And when it got to Wales, there was a terrible public scandal about these cartoons and all the rest of it. I saw Gerald last week. I hadn't seen him for years. And he got in a car and took a screwdriver with him, drove down to the gallery in Wales, walked in, unscrewed every single thing of his cartoons, put them in the back of the car and drove off. Those were the days.
Well, I mean, yes, those were the days when the police walked into the V&A and said, you can't look at the Aubrey Beardsley drawings.
Before my time.
Just before your time, only just. But I mean, that was an extraordinary decade. The police wouldn't dare walk into a museum now and close it, would they? Oh, I don't know. I don't think so anyway.
You could write a good book on museums, you know. From the point of view of the consumer.
I think I'm too close to it.
You know.
The trouble for me, of course, is that I'm always, when I'm reviewing an exhibition, put myself in the position of the curator. What would I have done? And so often I would not have done what has been done, and therefore, how do you judge an exhibition when, had you been given the subject, it would have been entirely different? And you?
Well, I still go to exhibitions. I went to the Manet.
Oh.
Well, I just felt with the Manet, and there were a lot of, I thought, why didn't they contract it? Why did we have one small picture which was in the National Gallery collection just alone in a vast room? Then there was a room full of books to read. I couldn't see what we were doing that for. Then I couldn't understand, why don't you put the really great things together, then have a room of sketch. I was going to say it was a court-old thesis on the
No, board. It wasn't.
Well, whatever it was, thesis things. No, and she was trying to prove something. And I just thought, God, this is boring.
No, I think we all have to recognize that the Royal Academy is no longer a charitable institution in any sense other than of being charitable to itself. It has to pay the enormous salaries of people like Charles C. Mary Smith and so on. And it can only do that by having what it calls popular blockbusters. And it doesn't care a damn about the
quality. What Brian and I will agree here, I can't think I was doing so. I was doing something like I'm doing with you with Sandy Nairn at the Porch Gallery. And you said, what do you think is the greatest shift in museums? Museums and everything, because of what has happened over the last 20 to 30 years, they are about one thing and one thing only, money. Money drives everything. I mean, to conceive of doing an exhibition like that great series I did with John Harris and Marcus Binney in the 70s. Now, okay, heritage is a dirty word, but the destruction of the country house, change and decay, the future of our churches, the one on the garden, they were all landmarks that changed public perception, the world of scholarship, government, legislation, and everything. They'd never be staged now. You've got to give them Fabergé Easter eggs, another ghastly exhibition on Renoir, and you're on the treadmill. And it's like that absolutely everywhere, and certain things are just not being said. And that's why I admire sometimes the court-old, hang on, who does those quite small exhibitions where they take a very simple thing just in one room and present it perfectly. But it's very tough in there, and you look at the composition of boards. They've moved from the old aristocracy to the world of academe, and now money.
Yes, I think this is the problem. And it seems to me extraordinary, the National Gallery, to which I owe so much in terms of my education, now has three rooms in which it sells largely rubbish. Catalogues, of course, but umbrellas and all that sort of stuff. You can't get into the building, either the new block or through the new East entrance, without going through the souvenirs and so on. And you go, in the National Gallery, you actually, if you go in from St. Martin's Lane, you have to go through two restaurants to get in through that entrance. Okay. And it is all about making money. I've just seen the Pompeii and Herculaneum at the British Museum. And there is an enormous souvenir room. And I rather jokingly said, you have no doormats with Cave Canem on them, because that's one of the exhibits in the show. And they said, oh, what a good idea. And you can admit, they're going to run away.
It's a very good idea. I'd have gone for that.
You could see they were going to run off and talk to a manufacturer of doormats and see whether something could be rushed in. And well, yes, perhaps it was a good idea, but it does seem to me a great tragedy that our museums are now geared to making money and that they have boards of trustees that are much more expert. For that, I think we have to blame Mrs. Thatcher. Mrs. Thatcher started doling out trusteeships to property developers and engineers and God knows what, and quite unashamedly saying, well, most museums don't know how to run their business, so let's give them some businessmen. Not a good thing culturally in the long run. But the Royal Academy is an entirely independent body. It does not depend on the opinions of trustees or trustees' wives, which are even worse. It depends on making money. So it puts on a show, which it persuades most people in the press, is a wonderful blockbuster devoted to Manet, who is almost in the first rank of French Impressionists. And it would, exactly as Roy says, it would be an infinitely better exhibition if it were a half the size and all the rubbish was excluded. But there we are. That's the situation in which we live.
I must say we've run out of time. But unlike the BBC,
I do very much recommend you go to the back of the room and buy the books. And Sir Roy and Brian Sewell will be very happy to sign them. Thank you very much for coming this afternoon. And let's thank our speakers.